Thanks for all of you for coming to watch me present to you about passive-aggressive behavior in SRE. So the title of this talk was inspired by a book called The Angry Smile. And so that that's sort of like a nice metaphor that you can use as we go for understanding what this term is. And we'll also investigate in detail what passive-aggressive actually means. So I come from Zalando, which is a land far away. We have a headquarters in Berlin, Germany. We are Europe's top online fashion platform. There's lots of statistics here showing how big we are, but we have millions of customers, and so we have lots of products to keep available and running for them. In terms of our SRE operations, so we don't really have a centralized team, but we have on-call 24/7 inside our teams, and we do have some dedicated advocates for the SRE practices, and they do trainings in our team and advocate and are very passionate about spreading the word. And we've, since last year, really undertaken blameless postmortems, so sharing information about incidents and learnings, and so we're building SRE culture at the team level in these ways. About me, this is my Twitter handle. I'm a Twitter handle myself. I have a few jobs. So I'm an agile producer, which is like a combination agile coach, project manager inside our core search team. So we do on call. I'm also the open source evangelist for the entire tech team. So if I'm not talking about this, I'm usually talking about readmes and documentation and user research and open source development. So Betsy Byers' talk this morning was awesome for me. I'm a member of the Red Hat Open Organization Ambassadors Group. So that's a volunteer group that leverages Red Hat's commitment to open culture and creates models, books, articles, et cetera, about how to spread openness in organizations. And I've been on the program committee of this conference since 2 years. It's an awesome committee. Here are a couple of projects of mine that you might find interesting, especially the first one, which is relevant to this topic because it's a list of resources for managing and leading teams and building accountability in tech. So why a talk about passive-aggressive behavior? Well, because I've seen this in action and I've seen the costs. So things that I've heard or witnessed by firsthand experience or just friends is the things that you might find familiar, these statements. Somebody else should create the alerts, like the magic alert man or woman should care and do these alerts that we just don't want to do or implement. Or I don't want to fix the incident. Well, your customers also, they want to use maybe their banking service or their social media platform, and so somebody's going to have to fix this, and so you could do it, or you could just pass the work on to someone else. It's their fault the service is slow, so it's somebody else. I'm not to blame. I'm absolved. Maybe it's even the tools, these stupid tools, ARG. I hate them. I hope somebody or nobody will notice that I didn't do this thing, and then maybe you have an outage, and then everyone will notice. Or I just don't have time. I don't have time to listen to you about your SRE stuff, this SLO whatever. Please leave me alone. So with this, I want to bring to you like why we actually, you can basically hear them. Like, I'm not passive aggressive, unlike some people I know. So I want to bring to you some awareness of what this is and how this might be affecting your lives as SREs, as leads, as colleagues of teams. So this is hopefully, and at the end I want to help you get to solve this problem by giving you some ideas about what you could do. And I'll also tell you about where this term even comes from. It's got kind of an interesting history. So let's start with what passive-aggressive actually means. And so the most legitimate definition one might find out there comes from this big book. This version itself has like 915 pages, so if you're looking for a long read, you can download this for free. The Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders has, in its fourth edition, which came out in the 90s, this description, that the essential feature of passive-aggressive behavior is a pervasive pattern of negativistic attitudes and passive resistance to demands for adequate performance in social and occupational situations. Now, this is actually in reference to more of a diagnosis instead of just maybe a temporary form of behavior. So this is pointing at a personality characteristic and not just a passive, a spontaneous moment. So we're not really going to diagnose people today. That's not very ethical, and we're not armed for that. And I'm not a psychologist, so I'm not really equipped. But this is a pretty reasonable and reliable definition. This book is used by medical practitioners around the world. It comes from the American Psychiatric Association, so it's fairly legit. In this fourth version of the manual, there are these seven criteria, and this is, I hope, the most text-heavy slide of the day that I've given you. But you need to have four of these seven to actually have the pattern to qualify for actually having this be a personality characteristic, according to the manual. So passively resisting, fulfilling routine occupational tasks, complaining about being misunderstood or unappreciated, being solid and argumentative. So some of these might come up in your lives when there's a postmortem and somebody just doesn't want to do it. And like, why do we have to do this thing like for pleasing someone else instead of maybe thinking that this is good for our team and this is good for us to keep our services reliable and running? There's sort of like this victimization dynamic that comes up. Unreasonably criticizing or scorning authority, and we'll get to this one because it's kind of interesting for us in the tech world where we're often talking about autonomy and challenging authority. Expressing envy and resentment towards those who we perceive to be more fortunate. Exaggerated and persistent complaints of personal misfortune, so woe is me that I have all these incidents that I have to think about, and these outages and those services that other team doesn't do right, that's where it might become passive aggressive for us. And there's also this dynamic of alternating between being hostily defiant and then being sorry. So maybe being more aggressive and then, retreating and saying, I will do better next time, but then not following that up with an actual action. In the workplace, this manifests in this kind of dynamic where it's covert anger. So it's not shying away. There's an anger. There's a strong emotion there. But what happens is that you try to mask it because you're maybe not comfortable with the emotion. And so it's really uncomfortable to carry this around. So the way that passive aggressive works is that anger gets transferred. So you say that you take a stance that I'm powerless. Like I'm not able to change our systems. I'm not equipped to handle this problem. And then people around you might realize that you're quite a smart person, so they know that you can do it, and then they will get angry because they rely on you to do something, and now you're kind of resisting to do it. This intersects often with narcissism because what happens is that it puts the self above the team or the company. So it's really about what I need and what I want, and that's not... it's irrespective of what others might depend upon me for. Forgetting duties is one common manifestation. So a person says they will do something and then they don't do it, and you ask them and they didn't do it, and then it happens again and again. Procrastinating, so hoping that someone else will do the thing that is looming, and then, I hope nobody notices that I didn't do it. Avoiding, also being stubborn. Blaming the tool, the boss, the team, and even sabotaging success, including one's own, because all of these delay tactics and being avoidant will mean that things don't get done and then maybe things will actually break. So I want to make sure that we understand what this is not. So it's not about being a quiet person. I'm an extrovert, but there are so many introverts who are very capable leaders, and so this is not about saying that you have to be like outgoing and energetic and rah, rah, rah. I mean, you can be extremely effective and be very quiet, even being socially awkward, but it's, there are methods for communicating that do not involve being on stages or being loud or being the things that some of us might be. And it's also not about being the hero or the rock star. So that's a common anti-pattern. You're not supposed to be like rushing in and saving the day. You know, look, here we did it. And because that's also going to be corrosive for the team if it becomes that you're special and the rest of the team is not. And it's not these things. So passive-aggressive is a combination of two of these things. Aggressiveness. So in a common standard aggression, it would be yelling, bullying, all caps emails, really overt control. Being passive, on the other hand, is being a doormat, apologizing for existing, giving up, not caring, just taking orders, not really challenging or contributing a unique perspective to the team. And being assertive, which is really where we want to be, and which I believe many SREs really encapsulate this personality trait. Being assertive means being clear, direct, honest, engaged, caring, and being empathetic and owning the work. So passive-aggressive is really about some of these stories. here's some really real-life examples in the field that are relevant to our SRE context. So one story is that a colleague of mine said had an experience where, we'll call them Assertive Alice. Assertive Alice told a service owner, hey, this service has an alert and there's an outage coming up. And the service owner says, well, there's no way that these things could be related because my gut just tells me so. So this is where you see that narcissism in action, because this gut, if there's no evidence supporting the gut, then you're basically saying to others, you just must trust that I have this magical knowledge that this is not so. What happened is that the person ignored Assertive Alice and then the gut was wrong. So go, big surprise. It also manifests in these. So here's maybe you know, heard the one about the product owner who says, I'm not fit or meant to define SLOs. Like, I just can't do it. I don't know. There's also the leads who ask for help multiple times and never take an action. Or the customer impact doesn't exist in my domain. We thought your domain was the company, but there's a special section for you where whatever you're doing doesn't affect the customer. Okay, cool. This story, so the friend who had this is like still affected years later. Even the emotions could come out over LinkedIn. This person is clearly traumatized. Basically, there was one member of their team who was like, I just don't trust you. You don't know what I know, so I'm going to hoard all these passwords to really critical critical systems and pieces of infrastructure. And then I'm going to go on vacation, and then what happens is there's an outage and nobody has access to these and they can't fix it, and then they feel terrible because they want to, and it's just a disaster. One of my favorites was this one, it's the customer's fault. So during an SLO review meeting, a service owner says that the customers created the errors and they shouldn't be hurting my SLO. And then it's like, well, your SLO, like what about the teams and the product and the company? And this is also common, like so in workplaces, this is not our personal example, I got this from the Google, but this note is, this is how we see like a lot of communications in offices that are kind of awkward, where passive aggressive is really on full display. So this note says, please throw your food out in the hallway trash. I think we would all appreciate the newsroom, so this is a reporting context, not smelling like day-old ketchup all the time, and then somebody, they say, they call themselves your passive aggressive coworker, and then somebody writes in ketchup, sorry. So maybe this ketchup person is evil, but probably not. Here we see, like, for me, it's like there's not trust happening here. Like, people are not working out these things in face-to-face. And what does that say about the environment? So are people feeling like they can speak up? What is the level of psychological safety in this newsroom so that they can be honest and apologize and work these things out in person? And so there's also this dynamic in this note about how passive aggressive is really great in the workplace if you want to like do something and or not do something and have no one know about it, because it's creating this whodunit effect. Oftentimes, there's this omission, and that is the problem. So there's a lack of evidence or actions to point to instead of being overt or having a collection of overt actions to look to and understand who is accountable for something going wrong. So where does this actually come from? So we've just looked at a catch-up note. So there's this ambient lack of trust that often manifests and creates situations where people don't feel like they can speak up. So this is obviously not exclusive to our lives. Comes up all in many situations. And so now we will take a little segue or detour into history and see where this phenomenon actually got a name and also grew in awareness over time to bring us to where we are now. So the history of this actual term passive-aggressive comes from the war, or the war context. After World War II, this guy, Colonel Will Menninger of the U.S. Army, there was a technical document where this term passive-aggressive appeared. And this document was referring to soldiers who, during World War II, displayed a passive-aggressive behavior by resisting authority, pouting, being stubborn, being inefficient, and procrastinating. So these were the characteristics assigned to the term. Now you might say that maybe they didn't want to be at war, maybe they didn't die, maybe their feelings were justified. But in any case, folks like Colonel Menninger really care about the teams working together and soldiers being prepared to do battle so that the whole team or squad or unit doesn't die. After World War II and this term gained some traction, the DSM started to come out. So the first edition was in 1952. And that edition actually described passive-aggressive behavior in three stages. So it took elements, there were three types. There were aspects of the passive side, aspects of the aggressive side, and a third type. It was kind of a mix. And this was a little complicated, so the second edition merged the two, and that's how we got passive-aggressive. By the third edition, it was already a controversial term because meanwhile, the psychiatric and psychological communities started to expand this term so that it started to maybe even create or apply a diagnosis to behaviors like complaining about your boss or complaining about your job. So this is pathologizing these behaviors. And I've listed some researchers who have done work on this history and some topics. So that's where this knowledge comes from their research papers. And if you want the links to those, I'm happy to give them to you after the talk. But one in particular, Christopher Lane, who is a professor at Northwestern University in Chicago, who I reached out to and asked if I could use his research, and he said nobody from the tech community had ever asked this to him, like, you know, because he's done a lot of work on passive-aggressive behavior, so I thought that was kind of interesting. But he cited the use of the term diagnostic bracket creep to describe this growth of this term. And what it means and what kinds of behaviors could be assigned to it. And when you're starting to talk about a diagnosis being attached to that, it can get a little dicey. While the community, the medical community, was talking about this topic, so did the rest of humanity. So this term passive-aggressive started popping up in popular culture, in books. With the growth of the internet, you now have psychology websites where you can read articles about it. So that's, and you can make memes about it, and we've seen them. So this is how the term has actually grown in awareness. Today, so the DSM-IV is not the most recent edition of this manual. The fifth edition has come out, but the terminology and descriptions of passive-aggressive are roughly, they're still from the fourth edition. There was the addition or changing of the name from the basic passive-aggressive personality disorder to negativistic. So this adds another, this adds a lot of the attitude side of the disorder criteria. And this has been a little bit controversial because, again, it points to basic pouting, complaining, not just as something we do, but as a problem, like a medical problem. So there's been enough controversy over that the passive-aggressive term and disorder is in the appendix now, so it's now relegated for further study. We said earlier at the beginning of this talk, I said that we would use the definition here because it's really the most clear cut and reliable and sort of standardized. So I want to just refresh you about what this manual said as we go into our next section, where we'll see this more applied directly to the tech environment. Once again, it's about a pervasive pattern and a chronic attitude and behavior. And it also involves these demands for adequate performance in the workplace. So what does adequate mean to us? So this is a very subjective term because we all come from different cultures. We all have different norms. Companies are different. So we might not be fully clear all the time about what adequate means and what our expectations are of each other, how we expect each other to perform, to show up for work, to show up and help out when we have an emergency situation. Today's war room looks more like on the right, but this is, the comparison and the same basic dynamics apply, that we need to basically huddle together to solve problems very quickly, and if one of us or some of us aren't really fully engaged, that will diminish the overall effort. But have we communicated the impact of that to our teams? And again, that points to whether there's adequate notice of what is expected of us. So yesterday, I think it was, there was one of the talks, like, I'm sorry, I can't remember right now, but the point was made about it, and I don't have my notes, so I can't tell you. But one of the points was made about how expectation misalignment can cause problems for us, because if the team doesn't have time or headspace to think about a bigger strategy, then they might try to do something in the interim that doesn't fully apply or take the team, the system, to where it needs to be fully reliable in a more long-term way. So if a team or if our teams are doing a lot of firefighting, we might never have that chance to step back and ask ourselves, like, what are we doing? Well, what does this all mean? What is our purpose? And in the tech environment, this can be tricky because, I've put here Daniel Pink's book, Drive, which talks about autonomy, mastery, and purpose as motivating factors for people in workplaces. We use this book at Zalando. We've talked about it and based our management strategy around it. But if these kinds of pillars are not clear or in conflict with each other, then it can lead to situations where people might, their only reaction or response is a passive-aggressive one. So there's, in the research, a connection to autonomy is actually being sometimes a driving force in being passive-aggressive. And how this happens is that if somebody is really valuing their autonomy and they feel threatened that it will be taken away from them, they become very sensitive to that and might then act out by resisting or being stubborn or complaining. Also, if there's some sort of dynamic where if you say there's a flat hierarchy, which is common in technology, they might respond, well, you know, then why do we have managers and bosses? We're all equal, correct? And so there's a little bit of a mismatch there, and maybe in meanings. So you might respond to something like that and say, but the team is one, and we're all here for the same goal, to provide a product and a great customer experience. But that if that's not fully translated or transmitted, and if there are signs in the environment that it's not actually true, then you will end up perhaps with somebody really clinging onto their autonomies, the first and foremost pillar of this. And that can then lead them to take it to an extreme where it's really that, again, that self versus the team versus the company versus the goal. So autonomy should not and does not mean like I do whatever I want. When you get this, and this does happen if you're not very clear about what the autonomy means, you might end up with chaos, people not showing up to do what they said, a lack of accountability. And what happens for those who do care and are accountable is that they often pay for it. So yesterday, Narayan Desai noted that a stress isn't in being paged, which you expect when you're on call. It's the expectation of being paged. and how often you might be at page, and are you going to be paged nightly so that your sleep is not going to happen and your quality of life will suffer. So it's really like, you know, how, when we're not showing up and taking care of our systems, how that will actually affect those who are then in the position of caring for us. If we look at the hierarchy of reliability, we can see that this kind of passive-aggressive behavior can have costs at different levels. So at the product and company level, you might lose your customers because you're just down all the time and they can't access you. Then this can translate into your reputation suffering. You might lose people, your best people, because they don't want to work in an environment where everybody's not accountable. Then you might lose opportunities because you can't build features and systems that you need to expand the business. Inside teams, you might lose motivation. The risk will increase because if SLOs become meaningless and alerting, applying alert stop, and it's too long for incidents to be resolved, then there's going to be a high risk of lower morale. And also a lot of questions about whether we even are aware of how our systems are performing or how they can perform better. And then people outside of our companies can be affected too, like the families and relationships with us. And then, you know, the sleep too is the biggest one, or most pressing one, because if you haven't had sleep, it's terrible. So what can you do about this? So we'll talk now about, or I'll talk now about some things that you can apply as SREs inside your teams, as leads, and even as a company to bring about a greater awareness of passive aggressive behavior and hopefully nip it in the bud. So what if, just hypothesizing, we could actually have emotional monitoring systems that would help us to just make a note of when things are going awry in our human systems? Well, we don't have a Grafana dashboard for this, but we do have ourselves. So our observations mean a lot. Being aware of what people are saying and patterns of behavior at both the individual and team levels, and noting that and questioning it and trying to understand where it comes from, those are all, you know, that's our monitoring system at work in ourselves. We can read about team dynamics and motivation and lack of engagement, and we can study up on the research to understand the more universal context for these behaviors. Dan Ariely is a great researcher for understanding irrational behavior. So, you know, why do people believe so strongly in things that are kind of fictitious? His research examines that and can help you handle somebody who's maybe putting more value on their cognitive biases than actual facts. So there's lots of tools, even in this room, in this conference, that we can leverage to try to get a handle on this. We have the moral authority from the Google SRE book to actually care about these systems. So that can help us if we think about like the tremendous responsibility that we have, that it matters, the work we do matters. So there's a nice mandate we can extract from that. To really try to understand these human systems as well as the technical ones. And then also values, so like knowing when something really feels okay and when it doesn't. So when one member of that team is really just not participating at all in a war room situation, like you have a point there in questioning that and trying to bring a different result. So some of this means maybe troubleshooting emotions. So being an expert, not just of the technical systems, but also the human ones, and investigating why it doesn't work. And I realize that this is time consuming, but you might find that the payoff is worth it. So when I think of somebody who encapsulates this kind of mindset, I think of my colleague Luis, who is also on the program committee with me and with us. He's not here today. I think he's in the ocean diving and looking at fishes. But he is somebody who, he brought about SRE culture and this mindset to our big company more than anyone. And he continues to train and advocate and guide people towards understanding why they need to think about SRE and take it seriously. So some of the behaviors he demonstrates really make him a great example for others, and he has a lot of respect inside our company. So he's realistic, he's reliable, dependable, he's kind, he's warm, he's friendly. He investigates, he continues to read about the field and gain new learnings, and he circulates those back into the organization. He communicates, so if there's a problem, he's on it. I've seen him fix incidents at a bar, or, you know, we're having a social outing. I mean, he's really dedicated, and even if there are others available to help, he will pitch in to make sure that the resolution is achieved. He's also good at mitigating and mediating conflicts, and really understanding how, you know, the different perspectives might lead to conflicts that one could easily remove with just a bit more understanding. So certain engineering teams might not understand, you know, his point of view, or where more DevOps-y teams are looking for, and he can bring them all together effectively. One of these, the primary foundation action, because it's not really a value, an emotion, it's an action or a set of actions all of these kinds of behaviors kind of fit under, is empathy. So Andrea Goulet, who is a consultant and a frequent speaker at conferences in the US, has this slide about empathy. She talks a lot about the importance of communication and how it's just as significant as one's code and making sure that we develop great software. But she brings this point about empathy. It's a skill. It's something you can actually learn over time. And it comes from a set of actions that one puts into practice. Listening, interpreting, understanding other people's points of view. We all have these skills as in the SRE context, where we're trained to investigate, analyze, find the cause. We have practices like the five whys that can help us really get to multiple factors that are causing a problem. So we already have these in our work, so we just apply them to humans. For SREs, this often manifests as patience. So some of the situations where you might find yourself in is persuading people to do things to keep services running. Reminding them of the customers and really being that advocate can help you achieve that. Explaining why we should care, why this matters, you know, that can help diffuse resistance. Guiding people to care, so showing them not only how they might benefit from following these practices, but also helping them to set it up, helping facilitate post-mortem meetings in a blameless way if they're not sure how, because they've always blamed each other. I mean, you can show them the alternative. Helping them with the SLOs. Then maybe you even have to go a bit further in helping them structure their processes. But you have that power to influence this. By using collaboration and being of service. You can get creative and even, like as PagerDuty did, invite the HR and legal teams to understand what happens during an incident, and that brings about new awareness. The value of this work becomes more obvious when others start to see the actual human costs of what happens when incidents happen. In that case, you know, I think the HR person said, "Oh, this is a mental health issue." I mean, that's a great win, because then now you have that understanding about why this matters. And then we can also simplify and focus on the facts to really help make all of this work seem a lot less intimidating. One thing that I do a lot, so as a role as producer and working with a team, we were in a storming phase. You know, as we grew, we're getting on call, getting up to speed. Better monitoring of our systems. So trying to understand the dynamics inside the team is often best achieved in a one-on-one. So, and not just having a conversation about, you know, what we did this weekend, but actually like taking those skills about that are attached to empathy, the listening, the challenging, the interpretation, and applying that into a pretty rigorous discussion with someone or a team. So what one does to implement this is you basically present a scenario or a question, not expecting the answer, and your goal is not, as the driver of the conversation, is not to fill in the information, but to allow the audience, your partner in the conversation, provide the content. And one great way to actually achieve a lot of value out of this is to mind map while they're talking. So you ask them a question, and then they give you the answer, and then if it's based on an assumption or emotion or not fully complete in terms of analyzing, like, all the facts in that particular situation, you can push and prod further and ask them, you know, and then they reveal the answer. So it's the awareness is coming from them, or maybe they aren't aware that they should be considering something. And in that conversation, you know, there's a gap in their awareness, and that will come out during the exchange. And you can write that on the board as well. And then at the end, it's like this person's brain has just been dumped onto a whiteboard. You take a photo, and then you can both analyze for patterns of thinking, assumptions, points of blame, complaints that might be unpacked and resolved by digging further and challenging those instances of complaints and assumptions. But it's a really great way to get inside of someone's head. And also when you have these kinds of one-on-one conversations, it's really good for building trust, getting people to open up. Not everybody will be into it or do it, but it can be fun for the person if you make it safe. It's not a silver bullet, obviously, there are none, but it can be very effective by applying, you know, this very rigorous set of techniques to a conversation. And what I've found is it really can puncture a lot of myths that a team might have about not being able to do something, not being our job. I'm a, you know, lone wolf, so I can't work with other people. And then, but what about that time that you did? And so you can have that kind of conversation and really push back on some of these assumptions that might be causing people to act in passive-aggressive ways. Honesty is your shield. So if you're the person who's trying to resolve this kind of behavior on your teams, using honesty will protect you. You can use it to deflect passive-aggressive messages coming at you, and it's really the most effective tool for doing that. Because you might be actually, you might become the target of blame. You might be this person that the passive-aggressive developer team will complain about. So you want to deflect that. So what you don't want to do is enable it. So admitting failure, you can do this when you're honest, and that is a strength that you can project, and that can help other people become more safe as they see you admit where you went wrong. Others might be encouraged to do it. I'm going to go a little fast because I'm running out of time, but with Agile, many of us are doing Agile, so this brings about, this helps us. It provides a structure for diffusing some of these passive-aggressive behaviors. If you have a definition of done in your team, that's a contract with your team. So did you finish the work? And if the team didn't make the contract, they can either get out of it, which is dishonest, or they can work harder, but it brings the focus on the work instead of you know, a feeling that we'd finished our job. You can apply additional diagnostics, culture surveys. These probably won't get at the emotions behind why a person acts one way or the other, but it can at least bring about some more data around how the team is operating. Once again, focusing on the team instead of the individual, you want to counteract some of that narcissism and the focus on the self by consistently referring to the team. And so there's can come from that, especially with retrospectives, we're focusing on the team health, focusing on what happened during an incident or an outage, how did everyone participate. You have to be very careful that it doesn't become like a ganging up situation on the person who might be displaying passive aggressive behavior, but you can do that with a good facilitation. And leaders and managers can bring about, you have a very important role to play by not enabling these behaviors inside your team, by addressing them head on. If one person is not showing up, it's your duty to examine that. Companies also, I'm almost done, is a company making it openness, a culture of openness where people feel safe to be honest and direct. This is a maturity model from the Red Hat Open Org group. It's based on, there's three levels for a company to measure their openness based around these five values. And so companies can use these and other tools to measure how are they creating a feedback culture. You know, is it safe to communicate? Google's work on psychological safety offers another matrix for us to examine. The takeaways are that you can do this, you can get this. Just being aware of the fact that passive-aggressive behavior might not mean that a person is passive-aggressive as their nature. It might be situational. They might not like the work. they might not like their company, and they might not feel safe talking about that. So what you can do is either accept it, which sometimes you have to do. You can also try to unpack it and work with the person if you have the time and the skills. But you don't have to succumb to it yourself. Don't enable it yourself by ignoring a person who is displaying passive-aggressive behavior, because it will cost you, your team, your product, your reliability, your SLOs in the end. And remember that people evolve, so maybe a passive-aggressive person today will become a more engaged player tomorrow. And you have a tremendous role to play. You can help facilitate that. So this is me. Thanks a lot. I'm after the break. I'm available for questions.